II to supposedly better protect federal research scientists. But that law was, at the last minute, the Senior Executives Association, which represents senior government managers, got a little sentence put into that bill that said nothing in the law could be used against government managers.
Hang on there. We're flat out of time, and I regret that terribly. But before we let you go, could you give listeners the website to find out more about what exactly happened here?
Yes, it's simply research misconduct. That's one word, researchmisconduct.org. So just go to www.researchmisconduct.org, O-R-G, and you will find my website.
David, thank you so much. You've been very, very generous with your time. Thank you so much for your courage as well. This
thank
has been
you,
Air Cascadia for Monday, June 9th, 2014. Joe Clement, engineer of the show today. Thanks for that, Joe. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. Free 'Em All is an evening of music, dance, spoken word, and political remix featuring David Rovex, international folk singer-songwriter, and emceed by KBOO's own Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners on Saturday, June 14th, 7 p.m. at Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Locus Focus with guest host Kathleen Stevenson, interviewing Christina Eisenberg, author of the new book, The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Locus Focus. What would it be like to live in a world with no predators roaming our landscapes? Is their existence critical to our own? Do we need to be doing more to assure their health and the health of the landscapes they need to thrive? My guest, Christina Eisenberg, argues that we need top predators in large, undisturbed landscapes, and that a continental long corridor, a carnivore way, provides room to roam and connected landscapes that allow them to disperse. In her new book, The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North American Predators, Christina Eisenberg describes the ongoing efforts of humans to coexist with wolves, cougars, wolverines, and other species in a largely wild but developing landscape. Christina Eisenberg, thanks for coming into KBOO while you're in Portland.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kathleen.
Christina Eisenberg conducts trophic cascades research focusing on wolves in Rocky Mountain ecosystems. She teaches ecological restoration and public policy in the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. She is a Smithsonian Research Associate, a Boone and Crockett Club professional member, and an Aldo Leopold Scholar. Her first book was The Wolf's Tooth. Can you talk about how you came to be interested in North American predators?
20 years ago, my family and I moved from California. We lived on a ranch in an area that got very heavily developed very rapidly on the Central Coast. The population quadrupled in about 5 years. And that wasn't where we wanted to raise our family. So we went looking for a place that we didn't think was going to change much, that would continue to be open land and relatively undeveloped. And we ended up in northwest Montana on a piece of land that is just south of Glacier National Park and is bounded by state forest, then national forest, and the Bob Marshall Wilderness, which is the second largest wilderness area in the lower 48 United States. It's 1 million acres. And so our backyard consists of millions of acres of undeveloped land. At the time, we wanted to live in a place where there was a very close-knit human community, which there is there, but that wasn't going to get carved up for development and where we wouldn't have a Walmart going in down the street from us. And what happened is that in learning to live there, that meant learning to live with carnivores. When we moved there, we didn't know this when we bought our cabin, but the highest density of grizzly bears observed in the lower 48 states is literally where our cabin is. Our cabin is at the locus point of that super high density of grizzly bears. There's something like 700 or 800 grizzly bears roaming our backyard. And we learned how to live very peacefully with them. And that doesn't mean that we have relationships with them. We don't try to photograph them. We don't try to interact with them. We coexist. So we respect them and they respect us. And we've never had a problem with them. Never any kind of aggression or it's been a very peaceful situation. So in that setting, in the late 1990s, we started hearing wolves howling. And around 2001, I was gardening. We have a little postage stamp size fence backyard. It's like about a half of an acre in size, which is a postage stamp in Montana. Anyway, just the rest of our land is just woods, and there is a meadow on it, about a 3-acre meadow. So we were gardening in our yard, my young daughters and I, on a misty summer morning. And all of a sudden, there's this explosion of sound. And if you picture this really peaceful, beautiful morning, the birds are singing. This is before climate change was really evident there. So it was cool. There were moss tendrils. It was like a very misty morning. It was a deer that had erupted out of the woods, and it was running for its life like I'd never seen a deer run before. It looked like it was running like a racehorse, its legs stretched out. And right behind it were two wolves. And the deer kind of ran towards us for protection. Well, later I learned that's what was going on. I was not a scientist there. I wasn't an ecologist. But the deer and the wolves came within about 20 feet of where we were. And we were in shock. They ran through the meadow and back into the forest on the other side of the meadow. And my young daughters, we knew how to track wildlife because there, if you let your kids out to play, you have to know whether there's been a grizzly bear in your yard that morning. And if so, you tell your kids, you know, let's do something else today. So my kids were wildlife trackers, and they were about 7 and 8 years old at the time. And they said, "Mom, let's go track them." And so we waited 3 minutes, and I said, "Sure." And so we went and tracked them. And the grass in the meadow was really tall. By then, it was like mid-July, and we could see where the wolves had stepped. And the grass was already springing up where their footfalls had been. They have soft feet. And I wondered how many times wolves might have run through our land and we just didn't know. Their trail was so fresh we could smell them, and it was like this very clean, earthy scent. We followed them, their trail back into the woods. And our land on one side is bounded by old barbed wire that somebody put up in the 1930s or so. And the deer had gone, you know, had jumped that fence. The wolves had gone through two strands of barbed wire, and they had left clumps of hair. So we collected the hair, and I went with my kids to the nearest natural resources office. It was the Forest Service, and I showed the biologist at the front desk, you know, the little Ziploc baggie with hair, the wolf hair. And he looked at me and he said, "Lady, those were just big dogs." And so here I'm a stay-at-home mom with two little kids, you know, and wolves are running through our backyard. And so I didn't give up I went to U.S. Fish and Wildlife. The biologist that's a second in command was back then of the Wolf Recovery Project. So this was around 2001. In fact, I dedicated my book, The Carnivore Way, to him. His name was Tom Meyer. He passed away last year. So Tom, I handed him this Ziploc baggie full of wolf hair, and he looked at it silently. He was kind of a man of few words. He looked at it silently for 2 or 3 long minutes. And then he looked up at me and he raised an eyebrow and he said, "Want to track them for me?" So he went on to encourage me to go to graduate school and become a wolf biologist. What happened on our land was within 4 years, we didn't have a meadow anymore. So we used to sit around at dinner before the wolves came back, and there's a window next to our dining table, and it looked out onto our meadow, and we'd watch deer and elk browsing trees and shrubs, eating in the meadow at dusk. And we thought, this is so beautiful. You know, it's pastoral. And, you know, elk are magnificent creatures. I was not an ecologist then, and I didn't realize that there was something totally wrong with this picture. They acted like they were tame. They would stand there with their heads down, eating and eating for like an hour without looking up. Wolves came back, and all of a sudden, in order to stay alive, those deer and elk had to become wild again. So they couldn't stand around eating, or they'd get eaten by a wolf. So their behavior completely changed. They'd take a couple steps, take a quick bite, then look up and look all around, you know, being on high alert. And then they'd take a few more quick bites, and then they'd take a few more steps. So within 4 years, our meadow became completely grown in by all of these plants that those large herbivores, the deer and the elk, had kept mowed down to ankle height, were soon over my head. That created habitat for songbirds that I'd never noticed on our land before, things like American redstarts, which is a UN red-listed species that can only live in the lower story in the tops of very young trees and shrubs like willows, which those deer and elk had kept mowed down to nothing, right? So that is something that we call a trophic cascade. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what Tom encouraged me to go to graduate school and study these things, and so did my family. The effects of these large predators on whole food webs is profound. I saw that in our backyard. Trophic, all that means is food. It's an ecological term for food. So trophic means related to food, and a cascade is like a waterfall. When you have an apex predator like the wolf present, its presence affects deer and elk, which are at the next lower level on the food web, by both killing them, but more importantly, by scaring them, so changing their behavior. And that, in turn, affects the plant level. So that's the cascade. So wolves indirectly touch songbirds, because then the plants grow when wolves are present, and then that creates a home for not just songbirds, but butterflies and invertebrate species. And we're just starting to scratch the surface on these relationships. So that's what I study, and that's what inspired my science.
And that is a theme of the book, the relationship between these predators and the other forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of my questions is related to that directly, and it is, why do we need these carnivores?
Well, we have done a significant amount of science, some of the first science with regard to wolves, how they affect food webs, is by Bill Ripple and Bob Beshta, who are two very well-known scientists at Oregon State, where I am teaching currently. So we have all the science. It says these carnivores touch other aspects of a food web, and by in doing so, they increase biodiversity. So because these trophic cascades improve habitat for other species, that means that a system that has these top predators in it sometimes has an astonishing amount of additional biodiversity than one that does not. And scientist John Terborg looked at this in South America, in Lago Guri, Venezuela, and he found about a 90% difference in biodiversity in a system that had jaguars and harpy eagles versus one that did not. So why does biodiversity matter? Well, because it creates ecosystems that are more resilient, more able to withstand disturbances and anthropogenic human-caused influences. So why is that important? Well, we have, right now we're dealing with the worst ecological, the most challenging ecological problem we've ever faced as a species, and that is climate change. So as the climate continues to warm, a system that is more resilient will better be able to stay ahead of that climate change. Organisms might be able to adapt more readily. What climate change is predicted to create is an extinction spiral. So the models, some of the more conservative models, suggest that by the year 2100, we will have lost at least 50% of the species we currently have on Earth because the climate will be too warm to sustain them. So if you're starting out right off the bat with a system with carnivores in it, large carnivores, that will have a lot more species in it. Those species will be better able to adapt to climate change, and so this can help reduce some of the extinction that lies ahead. So that is, I think, the most compelling reason why we need large carnivores. A second reason has to do with intrinsic values, or intangible values, as they're called. So why do we need grizzly bears? Well, because they represent wildness, and anybody who's walked in a forest with grizzly bears versus one that does not have grizzly bears know that those forests feel completely different. And just knowing that there are these large predators out there and we're not exactly at the top of the food web is a very healthy thing for humans. It has its wildness. So we evolved as humans coexisting with animals with sharp teeth and claws. And that gave us a certain amount of humility. And it's only since the agricultural era that developed in Europe and then European settlers that came over to North America that our values have shifted. And we decided that wildness was inconvenient and we should just wipe it out. So today, eco-psychologists like Patricia Hasbach, who teaches in Portland, and many others have recognized that wildness is a really important thing for humans to be healthy and whole.
I'm speaking with Christina Eisenberg. We're talking about her new book on locus focus today. I'm Kathleen Stevenson on KBOO Radio. And the title of her book is The Carnivore Way. Tell us about The Carnivore Way, what it is, and why you decided to call it that.
So if you look at North America, and you look at where all the large carnivores are in North America, there's six species of large carnivores that I write about. And these are creatures that are over 40 pounds in weight. So it's wolf, cougar, grizzly bear, jaguar, lynx, and wolverine. If you look at their ranges, they overlap in this corridor that runs along where the Rocky Mountains are from Alaska to north central Mexico. And it's a pathway that with radio collar data, we're seeing that these carnivores use that pathway to disperse, to travel. It's their movement corridor. Dispersal means it's different than migration, and all of the large carnivores disperse. So what happens is when they get to be the equivalent of the age of a young adult, or a human teenager, they leave home. And they leave home to find their own range, find a mate, and reproduce. And this is nature's way of ensuring genetic diversity in populations. So the carnivore way is that corridor where these carnivores are making that dispersal. It was formed 12,000 years ago when two ice sheets melted. When glaciers retreat, they usually don't even leave soil. So communities, ecological communities, have to develop from the soil up. This corridor, as these two ice sheets receded, they made this gap between them. And that is where plant species, you know, recolonized, and these large carnivores recolonized. So they've been using this pathway for 12,000 years. We had a policy in North America of killing every carnivore. until pretty recently, both in Canada and in the U.S. and in Mexico. And now we have environmental laws such as the Endangered Species Act since the early 1970s, and other nations have laws. I write about those laws in The Carnivore Way. So the reason we had killed almost all the large carnivores, and then we decided to let them come back. So the only reason that we have large carnivores right now is because humans decided that we want to live with them again. And so when we stopped killing them, guess where they came back? They used that same corridor that they used maybe 12,000 years ago. So I call it, it's my name for it, the Carnivore Way.
You mentioned the tracking of animals, finding out about where they go, how far they go. They have these incredible journeys, and some of them that have been tracked cover these incredible amounts of space and mileage. And there's a very recent event that happened that is relevant to that, and I wondered if you could talk about that and the whole issue of animals and their incredible journeys.
We have new technology that evolved in the mid-1990s. We developed radio collars for animals in the early 1980s. And those collars just emit a radio signal that you pick up with an antenna, and then you triangulate an animal's location on a map. In the late 1990s, GPS collars started being developed. And those are collars that work the way, you know, your GPS unit in your car works, right? And it took them a while, technicians and engineers, to figure out this technology and get it right. But now we have collars that you can put it on an animal, and they can tell you an animal's location within 3 feet of where they're standing. And they can collect 50,000 locations for an animal. They can collect locations every 5 minutes for a wolverine, for animals that move really fast. There's also something called Argos collars, and those are GPS collars who send their signal to a satellite in outer space, and that satellite then sends a signal back to the researcher's computer. Those signals have an error of about a mile. So they're not very accurate, but if you have an animal that's moving around a lot, they're one of the best ways to keep track of them. We started collaring animals to learn what they do. I don't advocate collaring animals because it is rather inhumane, but sometimes that's the only way to learn certain things that are absolutely essential in order to protect them and conserve them and enable their survival. And the wolf OR7, Oregon's wolf OR7, is a perfect example of that. So when he was about 15 months old or so, Oregon Division of Fish and Wildlife put a radio collar on him. Now, 40% of wolves, by the time they reach 3 years of age, they leave home, just like human teenagers. And why do they leave home? They leave home to set up their own territory and find a mate and have pups. And the male and female wolves disperse, you know, equally. It's not just a male wolf thing. And the other carnivores also disperse like that. So we used to think these dispersals were like they'd go 50 miles and find an unoccupied valley or something and, you know, set up shop there. These collars started showing that these dispersals sometimes were like 2,000 miles. All of the large carnivores, except for grizzly bears, have been documented making those types of long-distance movements to find a new home. So OR7 was a young pup in the Amnaha pack. He was collared in August of 2011. And by November-ish, late October, he left home. And he had an Argos collar. So it was just luck that he happened to have been the one that stepped in the biologist's trap and got a collar. It could have been any of the other wolves in that pack. It was just luck that he happened to disperse. And so people thought, well, he's going to go maybe 50 miles, maybe 100 miles, and, you know, we'll see where he ends up. Well, he kept going. And by the end of 2011, he was near the California border. And so ODFW does something really cool. They post data for wolf locations for many of the wolves they have collared so that the public can know what's going on. And they have a lag in when they post this. Usually, I think it's a month or two, so that you don't know exactly where that wolf is right now, but you have a good idea. Anybody can go online. They have an amazing website. If you do a search for ODFW wolf, you'll get taken to those links, and you can find out so much about there. It's very transparent. So the whole world was watching this young wolf make these big moves, and every couple of weeks or so, ODFW would post updates that were time-lagged to protect the wolf. And just before New Year's of 2011-2012, he was right at that California border. And so the question arose, how far south is this wolf going to go? Well, he ended up on New Year's Eve going into California, where he stayed for a little more than a year. And he ranged mainly in north central California around the Mount Lassen area. Because of his collar, we have this invaluable information. And so he was in an area that had quite a lot of cattle ranching and sheep ranching. And he was this teenage wolf. And everybody was thinking, you know, teenage wolves haven't, they're just like human teenagers. They haven't really quite learned all the rules of the road yet. And he was by himself. Normally a pack of wolves, they hunt together. So how is he going to feed himself? And was he going to be a good wolf? And he proceeded to be the perfect wolf. He ate small mammals and deer. He was in these ranching areas and never bothered the cattle or the sheep. There's no evidence that he ever did anything bad. He behaved the way a wild wolf is supposed to behave. So he ended up returning to Oregon in March of 2013. And in 2013, he went back and forth between Oregon and California. He appeared to have created a territory that it's a transboundary territory. It straddles the California-Oregon border. And then about a month and a half ago, a remote camera, so U.S. Fish and Wildlife and ODFW have trail cameras that they use to document wolf movements as well and wolf presence. They picked up a female wolf who looked rather pregnant in the same area where his collar was indicating that he was spending time. And his signal became very localized. He used to roam a lot, and that suggested that they dug a den and had pups. And so on June 4th of this year, ODFW managed to photograph, without disturbing them, two pups that OR7 and his mate produced. And these are the first wolves that we know of born in southern Oregon in about 100 years, since wolves were killed, you know, wiped out by humans there. And within a couple of hours of that announcement, the state of California decided to put the wolf on the state endangered species list, which gives protection to OR7 and his family. This is a perfect example of several of the things I write about in this book. First of all, that we need to understand what these carnivores are doing in order to conserve them. That collar gives us this invaluable window into OR7. His popular name is Journey, so Journey's life, and can help us find solutions to help ensure that he stays alive. And it's an indication of how wolves and other carnivores use whole landscapes on a continental scale. And so we need to start thinking on this continental scale, i.e. the carnivore way, in order to conserve carnivores. So OR7, his story isn't over. He's a very famous wolf. There's a film that's been made about him. He's an iconic wolf, and he really is our teacher. Whether we're natural resources managers or people who live in cities like Portland and Seattle who are wondering, you know, what's going to happen to wolves, or whether we're researchers like me, he's our teacher and our guide.
You're listening to Christina Eisenberg. We're talking about her book, The Carnivore Way. I found it very interesting to read about the boundaries and what would happen to a carnivore if they were in Alberta as opposed to British Columbia or something like that, because of the different rules related to where they happen to be, that was related to the physical boundaries of some entity. Mm-hmm. And so if you could talk about that and how that plays into the lives of these animals.
So let's say you are a young grizzly bear. You're 3 years old and you wake up from hibernation. And what happens, grizzly bears stay with their moms until they're three. And then when they're three, mom rejects them. You know, says, okay, you're grown up now. I need to go off and have more cubs and you need to have your own life. And that rejection is very harsh. It's abrupt. And the young grizzly bear doesn't know it's even coming. You know, wakes up groggy from hibernation and mom will get very physical. She will bite and, you know, very physically let her young know, you're no longer welcome to hang out with me. So these young bears disperse and they're confused. Sometimes they're upset. I've run into them in the field, you know, and they can be quite dangerous. Those 3-year-old bears, grizzly bears, are the most dangerous of the grizzly bears because they're confused. So they take off. They're emotional. They're feeling rejected and they start traveling. So let's say you're a grizzly bear and your mom gave birth to you in Banff National Park, Alberta. And so she's rejected you. She's kicked you out. And you have to find your own way. So you start roaming. You're a young male grizzly bear. In Alberta, grizzly bears are protected, have been completely protected since 2007, I believe. They are considered a threatened species. You're not allowed to hunt them. You're not allowed to harm them. They can be removed by authorities if they're creating a problem for ranchers, depredating on calves, for example. As that bear wanders, it has no knowledge of where these political boundaries are. It just starts going, right? And it follows wherever it sees good food. It's confused a bit. It just kind of follows its nose. And that young bear crosses into British Columbia. Well, in British Columbia, grizzly bears are not protected. They can be hunted. They can be shot for any reason, even without a hunting license. As that bear's wandering around, it doesn't know that, you know, its future totally depends on where its footfalls are falling. So it goes from Alberta into BC, where its likelihood of meeting a bullet, very, very high, probably 50% or more. And then it keeps wandering south, and it ends up in Idaho Panhandle. Now, all of this habitat is very similar, so the bear has no way of discerning that this is good or this is bad. In Idaho, that bear is completely protected again, and probably even more protected than in Alberta. And so this is why a transboundary approach is essential. The provincial governments and the federal government in Canada is working with the U.S. state and federal government. They have a collaborative grizzly bear working group whose mission is to conserve grizzly bears. There's all of these political boundaries, but they're meaningless to these bears. And so if we're going to have a thriving, healthy population of grizzly bears in Montana and Idaho or Washington, that means that they have to thrive and be healthy and be connected to the grizzly bears in British Columbia and Alberta. So in the carnivore way, there's a chapter on the public policy and environmental law and how differently these bears and other animals are being managed. The same thing applies to lynx, for example, and wolverines and wolves. And in order to conserve these carnivores, we really need to be aware of the big movements that they make, the legal policy fabric, and work together across these political boundaries. There's organizations like Y2Y who are really leading the charge in that collaboration across nations.
And, what's it called again?
Yellowstone to Yukon, Y2Y. So they have done a lot of very good collaboration, basically.
Is there a chance that there would be laws that would override and make a consistent application of law to these animals?
It's unlikely that any international laws be passed. Right now, there's an international law that prohibits the trade in the body parts of endangered species like pelts, for example. So you can't hunt a jaguar in South America and then transport its pelt to Texas as a trophy. That law was passed, I think, in the 1970s, and I don't foresee what it takes to pass laws like that happening. But what's going on is, earlier I mentioned that people are very aware of why large carnivores are essential to have resilient ecosystems. So climate change is affecting all of these nations similarly. And so they've learned to get on the same page. And so they have their own laws, but they're more synchronicity between these laws across these political boundaries.
One thing that I wanted to ask you about is the other kinds of things that make these journeys hard for the animals. I guess it would be called a disruption in the connectivity, mm-hmm. and some of the ways that is being overcome, particularly like around highways that have disturbed their ability to get from one place to another. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So OR7 and a wolverine that dispersed 2 or 3 years ago went from Yellowstone to Colorado. They have crossed very busy highways. The wolverine crossed an interstate on a holiday weekend. So they're capable of making these movements in these landscapes that have been highly fragmented by human infrastructure, such as roads and cities. However, some species are more resilient than others. Like wolves have very large litters and they have a very high survival rate. Grizzly bears have one of the lowest reproductive rates of any terrestrial mammal. They have 1 to 3 young every 3 to 4 years, and a female doesn't begin to have young until she's 8. So they came up with this idea in Canada, in Banff, the busiest Canadian highway, which is the equivalent of Interstate 5, which you know how busy it is in Portland, right? There, it's the Trans-Canada Highway, and it runs right through Banff. And it carries the same amount, volume of traffic that Interstate 5 does here through Oregon. They used to call that in the 1970s, the Canadian government called that highway the meat maker because of the high volume of roadkill. And there, it's a far north, so roadkill consisted of critters like elk and grizzly bears and moose and wolves and very big animals. It was very, very dangerous for humans as well as for these animals. So they came up with a nearly 20-year project to build crossing structures, both bridges and underpasses. And the bridges were these forested, naturally landscaped corridors that were about 50 yards wide that spanned this. And Tony Clevenger is a scientist who was tasked with creating a scientific study of this, and he started that in the 1990s. And so they've had 160,000 successful crossings by 17 species of animals, including lynx and wolverines and all the carnivores that I write about in this book, except for jaguars. So similar work is underway in the southwestern U.S. Corridor ecology is a very new field in science, in ecology, and it is a rapidly growing field because as the human population continues to increase, we used to think in the 80s that the way to protect these animals like carnivores was we need more wilderness. Well, we actually already have a lot of wilderness. What we really need to focus on is the mixed use lands. Like Oregon has a whole lot of mixed use lands where, you know, humans do things such as harvest timber and use those as their own travel corridors. How to ensure their permeability to something like a grizzly bear or a wolf or a jaguar or a wolverine that ended up in California, went there from Idaho, and then there's wolverines in Northeast Oregon. There's about 4 of them now, and they make big movements. So what are these bottlenecks where there's a lot of traffic? Like maybe the area around Bend is one of them. And if you look at on a continental scale where something like a wolverine is likely to move, then where are the areas that we need to maybe give them a little assistance?
I wanted to touch on one because living in Portland, it's probably the one that is the closest to people who live in Portland. That's the cougar.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the cougar and your assessment of the danger of cougars and why they should be valued, why they need to survive.
What I did in the carnivore way is, so there's three chapters that start the book where I talk about basic ecology, like corridor ecology and environmental law and trophic cascades science. But the rest of the book has a chapter for each of the six species that I write about. And and those chapters are structured similarly. And one component that they each have is a section that answers the question, is this animal dangerous to humans? How dangerous is it? And for all of the carnivores, what I found was that the incidences of fatal attacks are minuscule. There's hardly any. Cougars, for example, I don't have the exact figures, but the amount of fatal attacks in North America, cougars attacking humans, is really, really low. I'm talking below 50 incidences. There's a lot of cougars in North America. We don't know how many there are. That's how many there are. And they're stealthy animals. And so we can't really answer the question, nobody can, how many cougars are there? Given that they are very well distributed and they're moving, they like that urban wildland interface, I would not consider them at all a significant threat to humans. Where they can provide a threat is if you have a little dog, like a lap dog, and you leave it unattended in your backyard and you live, you know, on the edge of Portland or Seattle, you know, where there's mountains and big trees, a cougar will come in. And a cougar did that to a friend of mine's dog. But the cougar is not known to attack people. I work in an area that has a very high density of them. Our cabin is in an area with a very high density of cougars, and we've never had a problem with one. They are important because they are a top predator. So ecologically, they're very important. In some landscapes, there were never that many wolves, and cougars were probably the dominant carnivore. That is probably the case in Portland. Historically, there were wolves throughout the state, including in the coastal range. But the density of wolves that was reported, and I'm talking about the late 1800s, was the highest in the northeastern portion of Oregon and lower in the coastal portion of Oregon. So it's likely that the dominant carnivore in western Oregon and in the area around Portland was the cougar. So for ecological reasons, if we want to have these healthy, resilient food webs as the climate continues to change, cougars are really important. For humans, what that means is just being savvy, you know, not leaving your young children or little dogs out unattended if you live in that urban wildland interface. But I wouldn't worry about it. Really, the dangers are, it's much more likely, it's like many, many thousands of times more likely that you would have an accident while texting on your cell phone while driving than have a cougar incident. Your chances of getting hit by lightning are greater than being fatally attacked by a cougar.
Where do you see the hope for these animals? Where do you find the hope in your work?
I have huge hope. I've been around long enough. I remember when the Endangered Species Act was signed, and I remember when there weren't large carnivores, hardly anywhere. There were no wolves. And we call this the rewilding. We've rewilded the lower 48 United States to a huge extent. Now there's, you know, wolves in Iowa and cougars in Iowa, you know, where they've been missing because humans killed them for over 150 years. And so this has happened really fast. It's just happened like in the last 30 years. That's very fast. So where I see this going is we're at a threshold as a society. We're removing Endangered Species Act protection from wolves and grizzly bears. Those proposals are on the table in my book. I write about this. Because we've reached recovery goals in terms of numbers of animals. So with the wolf, we have implemented wolf hunts in the Northern Rockies, and they're very controversial. So our choice is, how many of these carnivores do we want? How many can we coexist with as a society Ecologically, we know that what we really need is a lot more than what was in those recovery plans. So we have to figure out what coexistence really means. But a thesis in my book is coexistence is a lot simpler, easier than we think it is. These animals are not generally as threatening as people think they are. There's a lot of fear involved. And so what I try to do in my book is dispel that fear and provide hope. And I do have a lot of hope.
Well, I want to thank you for writing your book, and it was very illuminating to me. Thank you so much. It's great to have a chance to speak with you. So thanks for coming into KABU today.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's really a pleasure to talk to you.
And I want to let people know that I've been speaking with Christina Eisenberg, and the title of her book is The Carnivore Way, the subtitle Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators. This is Kathleen Stevenson sitting in for Barbara Bernstein on Locus Focus.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Up next is Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. It has also been made possible in part by a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Since the 1950s, there's been a 100-fold increase in the incidence of inflammatory bowel diseases, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease. Prior to the 1950s, irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, didn't exist in the medical literature and now troubles over 15% of the U.S. population.